Welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Hello, Factually fans, Factually friends, Factually. What if I was one of those podcasters who like listed the all the different names for my fans at the beginning of the episode? Should I start doing that? I don't know. I'll think about it. Send me an email at factually@adamconover.net if you'd like me to start listing the names of all the fans when the show begins. But, you know, maybe we'll start doing that next week. For now, let's just jump right into it. You know, Jackie Robinson is rightfully considered an American hero. He was the first black baseball player to play in Major League Baseball. And he did it, and by the way, was one of the best baseball players in history, despite the torrent of racist abuse that was heaped on him by supposed fans and by a lot of his fellow players. What he did was incredibly historically significant. There's something a little strange in the way that we talk about Jackie Robinson, because if you ask a lot of Americans, a lot of white Americans specifically, they might tell you that Jackie Robinson was the first black baseball player. And that's not true. If you're a student of baseball, you'll know that there existed for decades Negro leagues, which featured hundreds of incredibly talented black baseball players who were every bit as talented and accomplished as their white counterparts in these segregated white leagues, but who received next to no recognition from the white establishment. So when we wrongly think of Jackie Robinson as being the first, well, we not only erase the contributions of all of those other black baseball players, we also, in so doing, hold up the importance of the white segregated space as though making it in that league was all that mattered. When in reality, there was tons of amazing baseball being played by people from all walks of life that is deserving of recognition. So why am I talking about this? Well, a couple weeks ago, I read an incredible book. It's by the author and comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff, and it's called We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy. Now, comedy is my field. That's the baseball that I know best. That is the baseball that I myself work in. And let me tell you something. Comedy has a representation and diversity problem and has for a very long time. It has for a long time been a space where white voices have been elevated and have had an easier time than everybody else. White, straight, cis, male voices specifically. Now, that is something that the comedy industry has been working on addressing by having diversity showcases and giving more opportunities to folks from marginalized backgrounds. And those are all great steps. But reading this book made me think completely differently about what recognizing true diversity really means. Because the story this book tells is of a century plus of incredibly funny Native American comedians working at an extremely high level in America without the recognition that they deserved. We're talking about Will Rogers, one of the most famous humorists in American history, who almost no Americans realized was actually Cherokee, or Charlie Hill, who was a contemporary of Richard Pryor, but never got the same credit that Pryor did, or the hundreds and hundreds of incredibly funny Native American comedians who are working today at a very high level, making audiences laugh all over the country. They're just not doing it on TV yet for some reason. Someone hasn't opened the door up to them yet. You know, so often the gatekeepers who control the traditionally white spaces see their role as creating a Jackie Robinson, giving someone that first chance, letting them be the first person to do it from that background, instead of turning a lens and a spotlight onto the incredible people who are already doing the work all over the country. That was a huge revelation for me. And God, this book is just full of revelations like this. So I want to get to the interview as quickly as I can. Today on the show, we've got the author of the book, Cliff Nesteroff, and we have one of the incredibly funny comedians he profiles, Adrian Chalupa. And by the way, if you want to pick up a copy of the book, We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, you can get a copy at factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books. And when you buy it there, you'll be supporting not just this show, but also your local bookstore. Without further ado, let's get to the interview with Cliff and Adrian. Cliff and Adrian, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I loved the book so much. I was interested in the topic going in, but the book itself, I think, covered so much more ground than I expected it to. There were so many stories in it. Cliff, what drew you to write the book in the first place? And how do you tell people about it? How do you describe it?
How do I describe it? Well, I try not to describe it. I try to hand it to people. You know, it's like difficult to describe to white people because they have no idea what the fuck you're talking about, especially older people. They just don't seem to grasp it. You know, I live in Hollywood where you hear the phrase diversity all the time. And yet I see this glut of indigenous representation. I think it's changing a little bit. The cynic in me wonders if it will actually have staying power. But I feel like indigenous representation in Hollywood is very, very deficient, despite the fact that studio executives are constantly talking about diversity, diversity, diversity. And sometimes indigenous peoples are just not on the non-native radar, especially in the United States. And I'm originally from Canada, where, you know, there's like a national day of mourning once a year for genocidal residential schools. So it's a little bit more on the non-native radar in Canada. Not to say that life is better there for Indigenous peoples, quite to the contrary, but at least people know what it means when you use the phrase First Nations or talk about residential schools. So in Hollywood, California, where I hear diversity, 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 people either don't know about that or they choose not to be aware of it. So it was a hard book for me to describe to a certain generation of non-Indigenous people or squares or what have you. Once people have this book in their hands or they listen to the audiobook, then it slowly reveals what it is about, you know. And basically the premise of the book, more or less, is about the importance of representation and the type of heinous things that fill that vacuum when there is no representation. And what drove me to write the book basically is that coming from Canada, moving to Hollywood and not seeing Indigenous representation, it just struck me as shameful and unusual. So I was sort of using the platform I was granted after the success of my first book, The Comedians, to try and do something, not necessarily from the perspective of the white savior complex, but try to do something of value as racism and fascism on the rise in America. So that's the context in which I started writing the book, was that pall of negative and intimidating Trump era politics in America.
Yeah. And the book, I mean, the book covers so much ground. Like, I think a lot of white Americans, if you were to tell them, you know, here's a book about Native American comedy, they'd say, well, how long could that book be? Cause they aren't aware of how much there is to write about. But you also write, there's a lot of just straight up history about America and Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples. But first, I want to bring Adrian in. Adrian, you are in the book. You are written about in the book. What did you think of the project when Cliff came to you first as a Native comic?
I will talk to anybody who listens. Just so I've spent my entire life just trying to feel heard and seen, and also trying to justify my existence and trying to counter narratives. So, you know, anytime I get a chance to do that in my own words and tell my own story, then I think it's beautiful. Of course, we Native people have had tons written about us by non-Natives. So that is not a foreign thing. No pun intended. But, like my family has had anthropologists pop in and out for generations and study us because I come from a very rare dialect. And, so anyway, I am very familiar with, just talking to people about my people. And with Cliff, you know, I thought it was really cool that he was doing his research, and that's really all I ever ask of anybody is just do some research.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little about yourself in comedy. Like, how did you get started in comedy? What's your story?
Yeah, so I grew up in Oklahoma. I'm Kiowa and Apache. And I got in trouble a lot in school for my mouth. I was a class clown, and that was not appreciated in conservative Bible Belt Oklahoma. And so I ended up getting kicked out of school, and then I went to a boarding school. Okay, and this is a government-ran school, and it's still in operation. And it's basically where some Native kids will go when public school has failed them. Mm. And I was one of them. And this place really instilled a lot of pride in me, but also I saw how diverse we were. Like, I met tribes from all over the place, from Alaska all the way to, you know, the East Coast, West Coast, just all over. So it really expanded my view of who I was, because I felt for a second there like I was an endangered species, and it was a very weird time. Mm. And then when I met so many other Native kids, I was like, oh, we're not endangered. Like, there's a lot of us. My school was a pretty decent size school. So like, it was pretty cool. But anyway, I have a big mouth. I talk a lot of shit, and, comedy has always been such a fun thing for me. And I can't tackle sensitive subject matter without comedy. At this point, it's a crutch. At this point, I think my therapist would be like, at this point,
I think comedy helps you treat sensitive subject matter better. I don't think it's a crutch. I think it's an enhancement. It's a bionic superpower to use comedy.
That's what I told my therapist. I was like, you don't know the powers.
You might have to drop this therapist. I don't know about this therapist if they don't understand this.
Oh, I'm looking. DM me, therapist. I don't know if I can solicit therapy on here, but yeah.
Well, and how long have you been doing comedy, and where do you do it?
Yeah, so I started stand up, like 15 years ago. And then never took it serious until about 11, 12 years ago. And just did a ring of casinos and tribal conferences. At first, I was very niche in tribal communities and wasn't really getting out there to like the club scene and the mainstream type of scene too much, mostly because I live far, far from LA and far from New York City and far from, you know, the comedy scenes. So, but then I pushed myself to start doing more road gigs. And so then I became a road comic for a while. And that's how I got my feet wet with, non-native audiences. And yeah, so now I am starting to book some live shows and later this year. So, they mostly are, for tribal organizations. Like, I'm still very much a niche comedian, but I like money. So,
I mean, aren't we all niche comedians? Like, I don't know. There's very few comics who aren't serving some audience who's like, oh, I really like this person.
It's true. It's so subjective. So that's absolutely true.
Well, Cliff, one of the things that really I did not expect about the book is how much, you know, you're both covering Native comics today and throughout history. Just tell me a little bit about how you came up with that lens, and like, what is it that you were trying to reveal? You said you had a mission behind the book, right? That you were like, let me do something that's actually, you know, worth something, or is, you know, trying to accomplish something. And what was it that you were trying to reveal to folks with the book?
Well, I just want people to be informed. You know, most people, I think, read my books and think that they know what my opinions are, but I don't think you could. I think people could make assumptions about what my opinions are, but I try and take a back seat, even though it's hard because I have a prominent attitude. You know, most historians don't use words like cocksucker every other sentence, but coming out of stand-up, I do. So it's like I got this weird kind of hybrid where I'm like part scholar, part pothead, and it kind of creates this sort of weird dynamic where I want to entertain people, but I also want to educate and inform them. And I don't necessarily think it's my role to educate people, but I do want my books to illuminate people and for them to walk away. Because in America, especially, people make such broad assumptions about things. They think comedy is under attack. Oh, cancel culture. Oh, PC culture. If you go back to the earliest stages of show business and vaudeville, minorities in particular are always airing grievances about how they're being portrayed on the stage. And would you please stop this? And fighting for representation. And so this tug of war has been going on the whole goddamn time, but people seem to think it's a brand new thing. And maybe it's because the hostility of social media puts it in our face on an hourly basis, but the general grievances remain the same. There's an anecdote in this book about the silent movie era in 1911, an amalgam of tribal leaders met with the president, William Howard Taft, the year 1911, and said, could you please do something to stop all these racist stereotypes of Native Americans in silent movies? Could you please do something to stop this spread of misinformation and distorted history? The year 1911, consider that Charlie Chaplin wouldn't be famous for another 3 or 4 years, and D.W. Griffith wouldn't be anointed as this blockbuster filmmaker for another 4 years. So this is like the earliest days of the movies. People are always or are already complaining that there's racist disinformation on the screen, and nobody bothered to adjust that, really. Minorities, a lot of different minorities, had less power in the body politic in 1911 than in 2021. It's still not equal. It's still not balanced. But I think more white people, maybe, I hope, are a little bit more aware of some of these things than they were in 1911. Who knows? Who's to say that they are or aren't? But yeah, it's been a thing that's been going on forever. So those are one of the things that I want to sort of illuminate for people. Don't make assumptions based on your own ignorance or the bullshit that you see on social media. Like, here's some evidence that this cycle has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, and the call for greater representation as well. Like, it's around that time also that I believe you wrote about a group of, you know, Native activists who are trying to get less white folks in face paint playing indigenous characters on television or in films. Sorry, movies and television.
Yeah, Jim Thorpe. In fact, after he became, you know, famous Olympian, Sack and Fox Olympian, he used his celebrity to try and push for some of those changes, even though he himself wasn't a Hollywood actor. Just like today, sometimes when somebody becomes really successful as an athlete, they want to put them in the movies. And so Jim Thorpe was sort of integrated into the Hollywood culture briefly. And he said, or he kind of organized this group with another civil rights organization. And they had this slogan, only Indian actors for Indian roles. They wanted to stop this trend of white people in just random face paint and feathers, which had no bearing on reality. They weren't portraying specific tribes, or if they were, it was this totally distorted version. You know, it was just like this amalgam Hollywood fiction. And Jim Thorpe was like, no, we want only Indian actors for only Indian roles. And Hollywood studio heads would be like, oh, that would be great, but there aren't any Native American actors. And then they were like, no, here's a list. And here's a list with all of their tribal affiliations. And here's a list of people that could work as advisors. Yeah, that was the late 20s, early 1930s. It sounds like something that would happen today. It sounds like Illuminatives.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah.
So it's amazing how long this shit has been going on and how long voices have been ignored and overlooked. And it's just unbelievable, really.
Well, and Dances with Wolves as a film was considered revolutionary for that casting in, what, the 90s.
And then that movie triggered a whole new wave of stereotypes because it changed the stereotype to a certain degree from the Native American villain always, you know, being an adversary to this opposite, like all-knowing, communicating with nature, that stoic nobleman, creating a totally different stereotype. So neither really are helpful in terms of what white people perceive as whatever they perceive.
Yeah. Well, what you say about trying to open people's minds to this, like, I think it's really fascinating that your previous book, The Comedians, is, you know, covering, I think, the what a lot of people consider the canon of comedy. But your new book really made me realize how limited our understanding of American comedy often is. That, like, people think that comedy is just like, okay, you know, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Eddie Murphy, let's toss Joan Rivers in there, and like that's the canon of American comedians. The comedians you cover in the book are like, there's an entire world of there's an entire world of comedy that people are not paying attention to, and there's worlds within that world.
In my opinion, the biggest mistake that people make in America when they study history is they confuse fame with significance, and they're not the same. So we tend to study only those comedians who became famous, and we're like, these are the significant people. But there's other people along the way that changed things, that tried to change things, that were important voices, or that paved the way for those people who later did become famous, but these people never became famous. So if you study the Chitlin circuit, my God, there's hundreds of black stand-up comics all throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. You've never heard of them. If you were to do a study of African-American comedians, you would start with the famous ones. You would talk about Red Fox and Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy, but there's all these people who were not given opportunities in what we could broadly maybe call the mainstream culture or the white show business culture, who were significant and who paved the way. And that's true of indigenous performers as well. So I like the idea. You can tell the entire history of America and tell the same stories that have been already told and use a completely different subset of characters than the ones that we're used to, and still come up with a similar theme, but different individual stories. So I am always interested in writing about the stories people don't already know about. Why would you write things that we all already know, that we've all already heard? And actually, I got criticized for that in my first book, where people are like, oh, you wrote this whole book and you didn't talk about, you know, whatever, some famous anecdote about Jack Benny that's in 100 other books. And it was intentional. I was like, oh, why would I include what's in 100 other books? I want to tell the stories that aren't in books already. I mean, right. That seems like logical to me, but that is maybe one of my only like real modus operandi is when I write, I want to tell the stories that you don't already know.
Yeah. Like, Adrian, I'm wondering that, like, I feel like I struggle with this in comedy, that there are comics out there and comedy fans out there who say, well, this is what stand-up comedy is. You know, they're like, oh, whoever's at the Comedy Cellar, that's stand-up comedy, you know, and everything. Who even knows what else is going on, right? And I'm often going, my God, there's so much comedy out there. I'm doing something different. Every comic I know is doing something different. I mean, how does that, do you ever have that sense as a comic?
Yeah, it feels very high school. It's like, we're part of this club and you got to be part of this club where you're not real, like you're not a real cool kid. And I've always been left out of the club anyway. So I felt like, you know, okay, like, but eventually people are going to get tired of seeing the same thing. They're gonna want to mix it up eventually. I've been asked to go up to the Arctic Circle because they were like, we're so tired of like just straight white dudes that come through here. Like that's all they get. And they don't ever, you know, if they're feeling wild, they might throw in a woman every once in a while, but like they're not, you know, And I don't like to attack like the booking people because I've booked shows like for, you know, I've been on that end of things. And so yeah. I understand that, you know, you're like usually working really fast and you're like, hi, can you, can you come for $100? Okay. You know, like, you're moving really fast, but also you're not like lifting up every rock to see who's out there. You're not really trying mm-hmm. to like diversify anything. You're just like trying to get paid. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I also think that there is a subconscious, deliberate attempt to erase Native people. Like, just because it's so convenient. It's so convenient. It's like, there's no, but I mean, we just saw it with like Rick Santorum, you know, like mm-hmm. it's like we can raise American pride if we can sell this narrative that this was just this wide open space. Nobody was using it. And
yeah,
you know, then it's this beautiful dream that we all thought of. The erasure is really convenient with all of that. So to me, it's like, you know, getting my foot in the door, but also like getting my foot in the door and then being able to like swing it open so other people can come in, because it's just, I do think the erasure is intentional. I do, because it's so convenient, like all the yeah. land, the resources. Sometimes I do the math, like money math. And I'm like, there's a lot of money in this country off of our resources and land and our culture. So, yeah. I've always held the belief that we just have a PR problem. Really, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. We have a PR problem. So hopefully this book will help our PR problem. But I also think it's just taking, you know, we got to meet in the middle. Like, it's not that Native people are hiding from anyone. Like, I don't know anyone that's hiding. My family is loud as hell. Like, if we were to all go out to dinner, we would be very loud and not invisible at all. But I think that it just kind of takes America really wanting to learn history. See, my problem here is just America doesn't value history. They don't. They just go, no, this is the story I was told, and we're going to stop there. We don't want to hear your side, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's wild. And it's wild to me that, I don't know, as a form of comedy, as like a sphere of comedy, a community of comedy, a history of comedy, that Native comedy is so not well known in the public imagination, you know, that like I've been doing comedy as long as you have, you know, about 10 years that I've been doing stand up. And I feel I've also been performing in niches. You know, like I performed for about 8 of those 10 years. It was basements in New York City, you know, and most of my jokes were about the subway and about, I don't know, hipsters or whatever. It was like shit about jokes about Brooklyn. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. How is that different from, you said you're doing jokes for tribal organizations, et cetera, and then also starting to branch out.
Yeah.
I had a question here about like, hey, how do you adjust your comedy for a Native audience versus, you know, broadening it out? Well, I'm like, hold on a second. How is that any different than what I did when I was doing New York comedy and I started touring and I had to learn to speak to other people? And why is the place that I came from the more famous comedy niche than the comedy niche that you were performing in?
Yeah, no, you nailed it. It is like, you know, you start in a niche and then you want to broaden your audience. So you do throw in more mainstream ideas and you go from mm-hmm. there. So it isn't any different than, you know, if I'm going to go play a show for, 'cause I do a lot of rural, I can't say it still, rural shows.
Rural.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard because I do have an Oklahoma accent. And so it messes up my R's. But I do a lot of, you know, country type of shows. And then I can go to the city and just switch too. And we could talk about subways, you know.
Well, speaking of history, before we go to break, I want to make sure that we talk about Charlie Hill in terms of such a, you know, main character in the book, such mm-hmm. a towering figure in the book. And I really have to show my ignorance. I thought I knew a hell of a lot about stand-up comedy when I was starting stand-up comedy. I read a lot and I listened to a lot, and I was not, I think I'd heard the name, but I was not familiar with Charlie Hill and his importance. And yeah, I wonder if you guys could similarly enlighten the rest of our listeners about him.
Charlie Hill was really one of the original comedy store comedians. I think the first time he showed up on the doorstep of the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip was in late 1974. So that's even before David Letterman arrived at the world famous Comedy Store. But in terms of what Adrian was saying about Erasure, they just did a Comedy Store documentary on Showtime and Charlie Hill isn't in it, you know?
Really?
Yeah. So it's, again, it's that thing about fame versus significance. Charlie Hill never became a household name, despite the fact that he did the Richard Pryor show in 1977. It really anointed him and established him in the industry. And the comedy club boom was just starting in 77. More and more comedy clubs are opening up. By 1980, there's all these comedy clubs. By 1985, it's just like crazy with comedy clubs across America. So Charlie Hill was well poised to start touring all these clubs after he did the Richard Pryor show in 77, did the Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson in 1978, the first Native American comedian to appear on late night TV, so far the last Native American comedian to do the Tonight Show or late night television.
Wow.
And then he did like Late Night with David Letterman in 85. He did the Merv Griffin show, Mike Douglas show. I think he did Arsenio in the early 90s. So he was a working comedian and a respected comedian. And everybody at the Comedy Store from that era, you talk to them, they loved Charlie Hill.
He was really funny.
He was like, go ahead.
Like as I was listening to the book, I did audiobook. Don't blame me. I was on the road.
Hey man, I'm proud of my audiobook. What are you saying?
You recorded the audio for the audiobook. Did you not?
Didn't you listen to it?
I did. Well,
you don't recognize my voice?
I do. It's just an excellent performance.
Who did you think was reading it?
Not a lot of authors can read their own books. Like, authors aren't known for their wonderful speaking voices. Well, you did a wonderful job.
This is that historian who says cocksucker.
But it's a feat of performance to do an audiobook. You got to sit there for a long time. I've never done one. It's like hours and hours.
Yeah, it's funny.
The number of lozenges.
Sometimes when you like read about records, like a famous album, and you find out the context in which it was recorded, like there's a famous George Clinton song from 1968 called Hey Mama, or What You Gonna Do Mama, and it was recorded during the Detroit riots and they had the studio barricaded. And so when you listen to that song with that context, it has this other like level to it. This audiobook was recorded, not to compare myself to that, but this audiobook was recorded at the height of the pandemic and there was a stay-at-home order, do not go outside, and they're like, except for essential services. And because this is Hollywood, essential services included like podcasts and other bullshit. So I had to go to this studio in West Hollywood to record the audiobook. And it was like nerve wracking because the studio was run by this old guy and he was sneezing. And I was like, what is going on? And like, I'm trying to like, you know, do this audiobook. And there's a director in New York in your ear and I'm in Los Angeles and I'm from Canada. So he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. You just said sorry. Take it again. It's sorry. I go, it is? Like,
you can't use your own accent with an audiobook?
Well, because my accent is so subtle, when it comes up, it just sounds like I'm pronouncing things wrong. You know, if I had a British accent, you'd be like, oh yeah, garage. But with my accent, you're like, this guy doesn't know how to pronounce things.
Like, you sound like you're mocking yourself. That's how I sound. Yeah. So a bad accent of myself.
Yeah.
Well, so when I was listening to the audiobook, I was like, let me go watch a clip of Charlie Hill. Let me go watch his first, that Richard Pryor performance, some other ones. And like, he was so good. Like I was like, why are people deifying? I love Richard Pryor too. Well, but you know, he was doing very daring material at that time and you know, things that nobody had seen before. And like Charlie Hill's material was so daring, so funny. And why is this guy not on Mount Rushmore with all the other folks who are so often up there?
Well, again, it has to do with that American conceit of fame versus significance. It's like, if you're famous, you're in the history books. It shouldn't mean that you're good just because you're famous. We know that from American culture. Fame doesn't mean quality, but it does mean attention. And so the history books focus on those who are famous. And Charlie Hill was famous in indigenous communities, like very famous. Every indigenous community still to this day knows Charlie Hill. And
Adrian's nodding. Yeah.
And people have stories. Yeah. Oh yeah. I met him at a conference in 2011. He was so nice to me. Or I saw him on TV. He was my parents' favorite. That's why I did comedy. Like that, type of story came up again and again and again every time I was researching Charlie Hill. But with white people, it never gained traction. But the Richard Pryor thing, Richard Pryor saw Charlie Hill on stage at the Comedy Store, and Richard Pryor felt that Charlie Hill was doing for Native Americans what Richard Pryor was doing for African Americans. Mm. And so the first time he saw Charlie Hill perform, he came up to him afterwards and he said, the quote is, motherfucker, you talk to those white people like they're dogs. And Richard Pryor was so excited about this. He dragged Charlie Hill into the parking lot. They smoked a joint together. And this is a significant moment. They're smoking a joint together in the parking lot. And Richard Pryor says to Charlie Hill, have you done TV? And Charlie Hill goes, no, man, I'm brand new. I'm green. I haven't done TV. And Richard Pryor goes, I'll get you on. And he did. So Richard Pryor had this sketch show coming out in 77 on NBC, a primetime sketch show. It had all these Comedy Store comedians. Paul Mooney casted the program and hired all these Comedy Store comedians who were all unknown, including Robin Williams, Sandra Bernhardt, Marsha Warfield. And they hired Charlie Hill to do stand-up on the program. He's the only person in this very short-lived series that does stand-up as opposed to sketch comedy. And it was that famous performance that you've seen. Mitzi Shore from the Comedy Store was in the front row to show her moral support. And it really changed his life and established him. But it was Richard Pryor who felt a kinship with Charlie Hill.
Yeah.
And a solidarity, and saw his perspective as similar to his own perspective in terms of trying to transcend subjugation or transcend the way indigenous people had been treated or looked at or talked about. You know, one of Charlie Hill's key jokes when he would open up his act, and he does it in that Richard Pryor set, I think is indicative of this. He goes, you know, my name is Charlie Hill. I'm Oneida. Probably a lot of you never knew that American Indians were stand-up comedians. Well, we never thought you were too funny either, you know. And that joke has so much truth to it, you know. And a lot of undercurrent there that you could read into. So Richard Pryor and Charlie Hill had this close kinship.
Yeah. I mean, when I was watching Charlie Hill's work, it's, you know, in comparison to what you were talking about with, you know, Native American representation on television before that, is white actors in face paint doing a parody and doing like a narrative that was written by people for white people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's pandering to that sensibility. He's up there and he's just telling the truth from his own perspective. And he's doing it really bluntly. He's saying, yeah, I mean, our land was stolen from us. Basically, that's the premise of a bunch of his jokes.
Well, and that's the title of the book, right?
Yeah, exactly. We had a little real estate problem. So to do that in the 70s, right, to just say those things bluntly, that must have been so profound for people. And the book is full of like example of, after example of people saying, I saw Charlie Hill and they made me, you know, he made me realize that like I could be a comedian too. Native people saying this. Adrian, did you ever have an experience like that watching a particular? This is such a clear version of representation matters. I'm curious if you ever had one of those moments yourself.
Yes, I'm lucky because I have, my father is a film buff and a comedy buff. And he, at a young age, he really started schooling me in comedy, you know, both non-native and native. And one of the first comedians he showed me was Charlie Hill. And I think he was just so proud of him that he made it to late night and, you know, was employed and doing these things. So he showed me these clips and it did put in my brain, oh, cool, you know, like, it can be done. Of course, the clip he showed me was from the 70s and this was in the early 2000s. So I was like, oh, is there not any more? Okay. But then, we needed an update, but like, but with Charlie Hill, like I have never personally met him, but I have a lot of friends who have, and one of them told me that like they performed and he was in the front row taking notes like of their set. And then afterwards said, you know, oh, great job. I have some notes, you know, and just like, but was really supportive, like, wow. So, you know, just like, so, and I think that's why he in with Native people, I feel like we do live in a different world sometimes when it comes to media, because like we will have all our famous people that they're famous to us, mm-hmm. and they're celebrities. And if they go to a powwow or they go to a big tribal event, they're going to get swarmed, you know, with pictures and autographs and all that stuff. But then, you know, the rest of America has no idea who they are. So we have a subculture within America that runs pretty strong. And with Charlie Hill, I do know one thing. I did when I first started doing comedy, I did a new magazine article. Someone interviewed me, for a magazine called Native Peoples. And, they were doing just, you know, little highlights of some comedians. And the interviewer told me, yeah, I just got off the phone with Charlie Hill and, you know, told him that I was going to interview you. And he said that he can't wait to see you on stage killing it. And so for me, just the beginning of my career, I was just like, wait, Charlie Hill's excited to see me. You know, it did give me a lot of hope and support. And that's been my experience, is my community has been so good to me, like almost like to a fault, where like I have always said, I will stop telling these jokes if you guys stop encouraging me, because they keep doing it.
Amazing. Well, we got to take a really quick break. I have so much more to ask you two. We'll be right back with more Cliff Nesteroff and Adrian Chalapa. I wanted to ask you, Adrian, that you mentioned much earlier that, you know, before you were a young person, you met all those other folks, that you felt like an endangered species. And I wonder about that dynamic a little bit, because like, I think I am as guilty as any white person who's learning about this stuff for the first time, to go like, oh, wow, like, I didn't even know, like, who knew, like, all that sort of thing. And what is that like for you, saying, well, hold on a second, asshole, like, I've been here the whole time, like, we've been doing this, like this comic, like, you know, Native comics have been doing it for the entire time. You're behind, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just something you get used to as a Native person, because people will tell you to your face, wow, we thought you guys went extinct. And then, you know, on one hand, like, I get it. The history books are super behind, so I understand that. But then I also, like, what always bothered me about that is like, okay, so wait, you thought that there was a mass genocide and everybody went a successful genocide, and it was like, and we all went extinct, and you were like, okay with that. And then you said it to my face. Mm-hmm. So that would always give me an attitude, because I was like, this is like, I don't know. It's just such a weird perspective for me to be like, yeah, we knew that like your ancestors were all massacred. And so what are you doing now? Like, it's a weird kind of thing. It's like a weird, like, how's the weather?
Yeah.
But it's such a personal question, because I do have ancestors that were in massacres and like, and went through some really bad shit. And of course, and have actively tried to heal myself from historical trauma. But the whole endangered species thing, like, I, as a teenager, that's how I felt, because also, like, our tribes, when you're enrolled, you get little cards, and the cards from the government, like the first card you ever get is from the government. And so it's like, it's like, I felt like livestock. I felt a little bit like a prized heifer. And then even our school systems, like, and this is true everywhere, I think it's still this case. So a school that has like a high Native American population gets money, like extra money. So they'll like have all the Native students fill out paperwork, like, you know, to like, it's so weird.
Wow.
So I'd be like, I'm a really prized heifer. Like, you guys are getting money from the government because I go to school here. And so that was a weird thing for my head to process as a kid. I was like, there's a There's a dollar on my head, and there's also a blood quantum.
I'll be honest, what you're describing, that also sounds like that happens in the entertainment industry with, like, you know, now there being much more of a focus on diversity in hiring or in casting and all these sorts of issues, and as there should be. But it strikes me, is that like a similar dynamic where it's like, oh, you've got something very valuable, like your background is, oh, that's really good, except that, you know, it's like back and forth. It's, you know, two-faced. It's like, you love me or you don't love me. Like, is that feel strange? Does that happen to you?
It's just strange because in this country, we have a fascination with Native people. But what mm-hmm. the fascination comes from the romanticization of us. And so I feel like people are a little bit let down when they actually meet us because we're just like, I'm a little bit of a dingy kind of airhead sometimes, and I think that's not what they really signed up for. Like, I think they want me in the forest, like, talking to spirits and doing sacred things, and I'm over here, like, lost on my iPhone. I don't know how to get back to the highway. It's just, I think they don't know what they're getting, you know, and they want what they, the idea of us. They want their story, their version of us, which is this like mystical Indian, right? And, then I have this joke about Johnny Depp because, I feel like this country now with especially the DNA test, right? That have all exploded. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to be Native.
I've seen the DNA test advertised that way. Like the one of them was running an ad that was like, oh, I found out I was part Cherokee. Like, it was like, this is bizarre to like, they're like offering people that promise of this weird fantasy thing.
Yeah. And then it's like, but what do you do with that information? Do you just like show up to the Cherokee tribe mm-hmm. and you're like, here I am, like, you know, and people do that. People do that. And I mean, you know, every tribe is different. My tribe is like actually kind of really strict with membership. So we're like, we are an elite club. So you can find whatever you want in your DNA and we'll be like, Matt, you weren't us when it wasn't cool, so you can't sign up now. But we're like health insurance. Yeah, we're like, we close. Anyway, but like Johnny Depp is like the perfect example because, and bless mm-hmm. his heart, but like he, the joke goes that like he wanted to be Indian. He got adopted by the Comanche tribe. This is true. He got adopted. Whoa. Yeah, they had an adoption ceremony. The Comanches took him in. And then immediately he started having money and women problems. So I was like, I don't think people really know what they're signing up for. Because if you really want to be Native, it involves some poverty and some lateral oppression.
But that's hilarious. But there's this dynamic of, you know, hey, people in the entertainment industry saying, hey, we need visibility, you know, diversity, visibility. Let's make Native comics visible or et cetera, you know, diversity showcases, diversity programs, hiring, things like that. But that makes it seem like there's this impression that the entertainment industry has where it's like, oh, we need to give these people a shot. We need to like make them exist. You know, we need to like make it possible for Native people to do comedy. Do you ever feel like, well, hold on a second, but we were here the whole time. Like,
it feels like a Make-A-Wish Foundation gone wrong because, and I've literally heard this. This is like a, so, are you Native American or disabled? Like we, and nothing against, you know, the people with special needs and people with disabilities, love you. But like it does feel like a Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we got a Native American. Oh, she's from the reservation. And, you know, it feels very charitable. And I even feel like that child. I'm like, you're going to make my dreams come true. Like,
It is weird. It is weird. And I will be that child, but it is weird. And yeah, we've been here the whole time and we're going to perform regardless. That's the thing. Like, we're going to keep doing our crafts. We're going to keep performing. We're going to keep making comedy and we're going to like make fun of everybody. And it's just like, basically, do you want to be in on the joke? Cause like we're doing it anyway. Yeah. So you might as well be in on the joke.
Yeah. I mean, it should feel more like, hey, do you want to, TV executive, do you want to be in on this cool thing that's already happening rather than giving someone a shot? But like the lack of visibility for the people already there is what really leapt out to me out of the book. Like Cliff, you wrote so much of the book is about Will Rogers, which I did not expect. Like one of the most famous, celebrated American humorists up there with like Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know. Before reading the book, he was Cherokee, like, and that was like a major part of his identity and his perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm not no expert in Will Rogers, but I feel like that would have, that should have come up.
Yeah. And just to distinguish for your listeners, he was not a white guy pretending to be Cherokee or one of these people saying I'm 1/16th Cherokee. When Will Rogers wrote about anything to do with indigenous rights whatsoever, if you look at his newspaper columns at the height of his fame in the 1920s, he says, we Indians, us Cherokee. He's always saying we or us. He's not saying they or the. So he always identified as Cherokee, and he was raised in what in those days they called Indian Territory. Later it became Oklahoma. His descendants, like his grandparents and great grandparents were involved in the Trail of Tears. It's in the book, but there's a convoluted history where his grandparents took a deal with the White House to move willingly instead of what happened with the Trail of Tears. Anyways, Will Rogers was Native American. You still hear his name referenced all the time, and you would think that at the same time, they would reference the fact that he was this prominent indigenous celebrity, and it's never mentioned. It's like completely whitewashed. So you talk about erasure. Will Rogers wasn't erased, but his entire backstory was, and he was like kind of rebranded as this white, all-American, simple homespun cowboy. When they mention Will Rogers, and I don't know who they is, but like through the lexicon of whenever he's mentioned, he's often referenced as simple. The simple American, the simple, simple homespun cowboy. Like the dude was indigenous, born in 1879, then becomes the most famous celebrity on earth. Could not be more complex, you know?
Yeah.
And yet they rebrand him as simplistic. Yeah, a really, really interesting and complicated character. I myself didn't know that much about him before I started researching him. I knew that he was Native American, but I too was sort of brainwashed by this version that made me not want to be interested in him when I was writing my previous book, because the way he sold to us is this boring simpleton. Everybody likes him, a great American wit. And then they quote these lines that make no sense. Never met a man I didn't like. I'm like, well, where's the funny part? Where's the joke part? Where's the wit part? It's just a sentence. And what the fuck does that mean? Never met a man I didn't like. Why is that famous? And then when I looked into it, I found out the reason it was famous is because they put that quote on a postage stamp in 1952, a Will Rogers postage stamp. And that's what made that quote famous. It wasn't because people thought it was this brilliant quip.
Oh, wow.
You know, anyways, there's so much about Will Rogers, but I think it's like kind of telling the fact this guy is like the most famous celebrity of his time. There's still things named after him everywhere. Here in Los Angeles, there's Will Rogers State Park and a Will Rogers Beach and a Will Rogers museum. And in Oklahoma, there's all kinds of highways and things named after Will Rogers. And everywhere there's hospitals. And, you know, so people know the name, but seldom is his indigenous backstory included. And in my mind, you would think that would be the number one thing that they would mention, you know, especially this goes back to that thing I was saying about Hollywood and diversity. If somebody is and this is not to disparage any other person, but if somebody is the first prominent African-American to do something, that's, you know, will be the first thing that we mention about that person. With Will Rogers, his indigenous backstory is like the last thing that's mentioned.
It's like if nobody mentioned that Jackie Robinson was black or something like that. It's like,
it is like that. And so it's sort of strange. So I tried to recalibrate his position in the book. Most of the book is not me actually writing. It's me just quoting people I talk to. So for instance, Adrian talks about blood quantum in the book. And the first time I talked to Adrian over the phone, I was like, I don't think a lot of white people even know what the phrase blood quantum means.
Is it a James Bond movie? That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, I like that better.
So when I talked to Adrian for the first time, I was like, could you explain for the white people at home, blood quantum, in your own words, what is it? What are the problems behind it? If any of the history of it, blah, 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 blah. What should people know about blood quantum? And so that's what's in the book. It's not me explaining blood quantum. It's Adrian explaining blood quantum verbatim. I just quoted her. So I did that for the majority of the book. But for somebody like Will Rogers from the past, I researched his life and I curated every single line I could find in his writings about Native Americans, which were quite a lot. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to put them all in one place in his own words. Here's Will Rogers talking about being Cherokee or where he's from and his attitudes about different Native issues. I don't think that had been done before. So I'm proud to have done that.
I mean, it's such an inversion of literally the only thing I knew about him was that he was the cowboy comedian, right? And I was like, no, I should have known that he was the Cherokee comedian. But I guess part of it is also it's the America's erasure of the fact that there were Native American cowboys as well, that we separated those two things out. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the attitude is always the stereotype. If you don't fit the stereotype, then you can't.
Yeah.
Then
how could he be Cherokee? He was a cowboy.
Yeah, but like, he's wearing a cowboy hat instead of feathers. How could he possibly be? And that is such a ridiculous conceit, but that is sort of the conceit. And he himself never said that he wasn't. He used to bill himself when he was touring in vaudeville as the Cherokee Kid. Will Rogers, the Cherokee Kid. That was his initial billing when he was touring around. So he never hid it. You know, he was an enrolled member. And in 1906, he received a payment of reparations for land that he lost, that his family lost during the Dawes Act of 1887. So he was very much prominent Native American figure.
Wow. I mean, there's so many stories like this in this book. I really recommend people checking out. I'm curious to ask either of you, do you feel that, you know, this historical erasure, this lack of visibility, is this changing at all, given, you know, there's been so much talk in Hollywood about these issues? Do you feel, Adrian, I see you making a face, so I'm curious to know what you'll say. Do you feel that positive movement has been made, or is it all, you know, optics?
Yes, I can say it is changing because all at one time there were last year, I think there were three shows with Native writers, greenlit at the same time with Native main characters, and then one that I had the pleasure of working on is called Rutherford Falls, and
oh, it's so good.
Yeah, and it was funny because I was listening to Sierra Teller Ornelas talk about the process and everything. And then they were talking about how they had a wealth of talent. Because I think in the past, executives and bigwigs were like, well, we can't make a show like this. We don't, you know, we don't have this, we don't have that, and blah, 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 blah. And then they just proved that completely wrong. They had so much talent to draw upon, and things are definitely changing. It's almost like we've just been waiting, just kind of just like waiting for the chance to pounce and tell our stories. And now that time is here. And now, I mean, it was weird. It was like, I went from like getting no auditions and nobody would call me back. And it was just this weird thing where, and I was used to it. I'm cool with rejection. And I was so used to it. And then all of a sudden, like, Yeah, it was like a bunch of auditions and a bunch of characters and a lot of stories. And I was like, this is weird. This is happening. So it's pretty cool. And I think it's just going to keep happening. And what really changed for me is when Rick Santorum got fired from CNN. And let me tell you why. Because in the past, you could be anybody, anyone. And you could say anything racist about natives at any point, and your job would never be on the line. Your political career would never be on the line. There were literally no repercussions to trashing or being racist to natives. And then this was the first time where I saw the political power actually take place. And it has a lot to do with our organizing, and we're here and we're paying attention and we have Twitter accounts. But also, like, people don't know that Arizona got flipped to blue because of, in part because of natives. Like, natives helped flip Arizona to a Democratic state because they have a lot of numbers and they voted, and that's what happened, and they organized. And so, like, things are changing where the visibility is there, but it's like, do you want to see it? Because even when we flipped Arizona, CNN was like doing the demographics, you know, white voters, black voters, Latino. And then they did a graphic for natives that said something else. Like, they wouldn't even list us. So now the big joke in Indian country is like, oh yeah, I'm a proud something else. because this is the shit that we deal with. It's like, even when we organize and we vote and we have a big voice and we're like doing big things, you know, media networks will be like, we can't quite figure out what these people are and what they're doing. Oh, there's something else. And so anyway, that's the big joke. Things are changing. And so now I love it that people are having to be like, wait, can we not say powwow anymore? No, you can't. you're going to get roasted. People are going to make fun of you.
Well, that's the best response, right? To be roasted. Like, that is just to know that someone's going to come make fun of you is like, that's the best justice in this situation for your ignorance. Like, you don't need to, you know, Rick Santorum getting fired, him getting made fun of is the best part. Like, for like, what a dumbass thing to say.
Yeah. And you know, it's the least that could, it's not like it used to be. Okay. My answers, I'm Kiowa and Apache. Okay. We used to literally circle the wagons and burn them. We took all the supplies and we burned them. And it was so bad that the military had to come in and put a Fort Sill is what it's called, right next to us to just like keep an eye on us because we were very upset. We were very upset with this. So we're not burning wagons anymore. So the least that we could do is roast and not burn wagons. And that's where we're at.
I will say, though, you said that it's the best thing is to make fun of Rick Santorum. I do think that him getting fired is the best thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was getting made fun of for 3 weeks, and then they finally fired the cocksucker. A lot of us were waiting for that son of a bitch to be fired, and it seemed to be taking forever. And at the exact same week that Rick Santorum made those comments, I think it was on a Tuesday, or at least that video came out on a Tuesday. That Sunday, I was in a new show on CNN called Story of Late Night, and I was proud to be in the show, and I wanted to promote the show. And here I have this book that is all about, you know, the history of the Rick Santorums and the fuckery that they engage in. And I was very torn, you know, and this is going to sound really flippant. Obviously, I have no idea what it is like to be indigenous in America. But for a week, I felt this fucking terror inside of me where I was like, do I like fucking burn my bridges to speak out? Do I stay silent because I want to be on TV? You know, I was totally torn apart here with a crisis of conscience, knowing the subject matter and the premise of my new book. And am I a hypocrite for not doing more, for not like, I'm on CNN and they're the ones that are paying this son of a bitch who's spreading this racist disinformation, which I supposedly as a decent white ally I'm speaking out against. So I had all this shit swirling around my mind and my conscience. And it was a weird and awkward series of weeks. So all the making fun of Rick Santorum was small comfort for me, where I was just like, what is the solution? And I think everybody now, because of corporate consolidation, a lot of us are working for the devil, essentially. Like you boycott CNN, you're boycotting AT&T. AT&T owns HBO, they own this, they own that. And then what are your other options? You got HBO, Viacom, Comcast, Disney, or News Corp, all cocksucking corporations. This book is published by Simon & Schuster. They're owned by Viacom. They just gave a book deal to Mike Pence. They gave $2 million to John Bolton.
I feel the same way when I go to Chick-fil-A. We got to pick our poison. So it's all good, you know?
Well, the fact that, you know, there is some change happening here is very encouraging. How do you suggest, I'd like to hear from both of you, how folks at home can participate in it, how they can, you know, what are your favorite native comics that they should check out, and how can they go see, you know, how can they be a part of this?
Okay, well, I say just follow comedians, you know, just like follow causes and stay educated. And if you think you know, you probably don't. So do a little more research and just stay informed and stay in touch and like literally just follow people. If they have a show, go buy a ticket, because most of this stuff happens because we, like when I was doing the casino circuit, and these are native casinos, like these are owned by native casinos, but they have their loyalty is not to give their people show gigs. Their loyalty is to make money. So they're like, well, how many people can you bring in and all that stuff? And so it's, if you just go to a show, honestly, that's like doing the bare minimum, or buy something, buy the product and just support that way. That's the bare minimal way to support. But, also my Venmo is open. So
what is it?
Oh, it's Adrian - Chalupa.
Okay, great.
I have four kids. Don't forget the dash. I like to guilt people, so I do have four kids. Cliff, do you know a lot of comedians? So do you plug?
Yeah, how do you break, Cliff? You know, how do you break out of that? You know, that narrow comedy canon and find the cool shit that you know so much about.
Well, there's a mini renaissance happening right now of indigenous artists. You know, I think there's like, it's a cliche to say that people stand on the shoulders of those who came before. But right now there's this interesting confluence of indigenous artists who are also informed by popular culture. So there's more than one native Comic-Con out there. There's brilliant indigenous visual artists, hip hop, you know, all these sort of confluences. The cover of the book, we had a little real estate problem, is designed by Ryan Redcorn and his group, Buffalo Nickel Creative, who are visual designers who do gorgeous work. Their posters are amazing. I was really flattered that Ryan offered to do the cover for the book. And I was really happy to have an indigenous artist do the cover, because when I got the book deal, I had all this fear. And like, I was like, are they going to assign some white person to do the cover? And it's going to be like a stereotypical image on the cover of the book, you know, all these things. And am I rocking the boat too much if I demand the publisher hire, you know, native photographers and indigenous artists? I want them to, but I also don't want to like be, you know, a pain in the ass in the sense that, oh, we don't want to work with this guy. He's, you know, and even when I'm promoting this book, the funny thing is, and I got to give you guys credit, like I didn't have to say anything and nobody else had to say anything, but sometimes I'll do a show like this and they just book me and it's two white hosts, well-meaning white liberals talking about representation and diversity is three fucking white people talking. And I'm like, and I don't mean to be an asshole, but I'm like, well, every time they ask me the question, I'm like, are you going to book a native guest? Like, is this going to go live to tape, or are we going to stop and you can book somebody else? And I have done that a bunch of times, you know, it's like, reach out to the people that are in this book and talk to them first. Talk to me second, you know? People just don't think, even well-meaning people. And that's I think, indicative of American culture is like, you're just not aware. So you want to be more aware. You want to support Native artists. There's a lot out there. You can follow Illuminatives, Buffalo Nickel Creative, Adrian, the 1491s.
The 1491s are great. We didn't even talk about them.
Yeah, you can consult the index of this book and find all kinds of different names. Also, watch these shows that are coming out. Rutherford Falls is streaming on Peacock. It's a really funny show. I really enjoyed it because I was able to catch in jokes and references that before this book I may not have. The show operates on two different levels. If you're a non-native or if you're a native, it's going to be more enriching for indigenous people to watch this show because there are jokes there that everybody will get that a white audience might not, but there's enough there.
I love that because I've seen the show and I love it. And now I love that there's a layer that I don't know. Yeah. That makes me want to go watch it again. Or like, hopefully, maybe I don't know if someone's written a breakdown anywhere of like, cause I, when there's an in joke, I want to understand it. I want to get inside the joke. No offense, but that's my attitude.
I mean, there's even insider stuff in Rutherford Falls. It's not even a joke, but just, when one of the lead characters is complimented by an elder, there's this really like sort of beautiful, sweet scene about how meaningful it is to her and how it's more meaningful than, you know, something else being praised by a celebrity or something like else for this character. And I don't know, it's just a really interesting show on multiple levels and revolutionary in the sense that it's got a mostly indigenous cast, mostly indigenous writers' room, and is just a funny, strong show. You know, anybody who likes 30 Rock or Parks and Rec, that style of comedy, they're going to love Rutherford Falls, but it's introducing an important and valuable point of view that has been absent from popular culture for as long as we can think. So watch Rutherford Falls. There's a show coming out called Reservation Dogs on FX that Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi have co-created. If you like Jojo Rabbit, if you like the 1491s, check out that show. It hasn't come out yet, but it looks like it's going to be great. Yeah, there's just a mini renaissance happening right now of indigenous art and creativity. And you're going to find good stuff no matter who you are, no matter what your tastes are. If you put in the effort to seek it out, you're going to find some good things.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a whole world of stuff out there that I mean, bust out of your box and go find it. I can't thank you both enough for coming on the show. So the book is called One More Time. We had a little real estate problem. You can pick up a copy at factuallypod.com/books if you want to support the show in your local bookstore. And Adrian, plug your shit. Just where can people go find more about you and see your comedy?
I'm on Twitter, Adrian Comedy, Instagram, Adrian Chalupa. I just started a TikTok. I don't know what I'm doing. The content is really poor. I have a website. It's chalupa.com. And I'm a screenwriter. I'm getting my master's in screenwriting. So I do a lot and I'm everywhere. I'm everywhere and nowhere. Think about that. So thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Look for Adrian Chalupa everywhere and nowhere. Cliff Nesteroff, thank you so much. Thank you guys.
Thanks, Adam.
Well, thank you once again to Cliff and Adrian for coming on the show. The book, once again, is called We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy. And if you want to get a copy, you can pick it up at factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books. And when you do, you'll be supporting not just this show, but your local bookstore as well. That is it for us this week on Factually. I want to thank our producers, Chelsea Jacobson and Sam Roudman, Andrew Carson, our engineer, Andrew WK, for our theme song, the fine folks at Falcon Northwest for building me the incredible custom gaming PC that I'm recording this very episode on. You can check them out for yourself at falconnorthwest.com. And hey, if you want to send me an email or comment about the show, you can send it to factually@adamconover.net. I do read every single email that you send. And you can find me online at adamconover.net or on social media at adamconover, wherever you get your social media. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to Factually. We'll see you next week.